Managing Violence Podcast, Season 6, Episode 4, with legendary trainer and grandmaster of Kaju Kembo, the Pitmaster, John Hackleman.
You never hear Joe Rogan say, well, that guy's terrible. He's just way too tough. You can't be too tough. Okay, I don't want a tough guy who acts like a tough guy. I don't want that. He's out of here. But I want a tough person. I want a person that has toughness. There's no downside to being tough. You cannot be too tough, but you can definitely be not tough enough. And that's very easy, especially in this day and age.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Managing Violence Podcast, Season 6, Episode 4, with legendary MMA and martial arts trainer John Hackleman. John is most famously known as the trainer of Chuck Liddell, Glover Teixeira, Court McGee, and a host of other UFC fighters. And also, as I learned in this episode, Tim Kennedy's first martial arts coach. So that's pretty cool. John is a martial artist first and foremost who grew up learning martial arts to keep himself safe growing up in Hawaii. And then became a professional boxer and kickboxer and eventually trainer of champions. John's also a registered nurse, a former soldier, and worked in corrections and is a school owner. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. It's a really, really interesting conversation. I'm so grateful that a legend like John Hackleman has made himself available for this podcast and to share his knowledge. So as soon as we give our thanks to our brand new sponsor, Australian Warfighters Coffee, let's jump straight into the interview. Managing Violence Podcast is brought to you by Australian Warfighters Coffee. Now, as you guys know, I interview guests from all over the world, which means that I'm quite frequently working on the show either very early in the morning or very late at night. So between a full-time job, an unusual schedule, and four children, I consume a lot of coffee. And given that I live in the coffee capital of Australia, I can be a little bit picky with what I choose to consume for my caffeine, depending on what's available at the time and how urgently I need it. But Australian Warfighters Coffee not only make a top-notch blend, but they also give back to the Australian veteran community by investing in training, education, and employment for our Aussie troops. So we'd like you to support those that support us, and in turn help Aussie veterans with the transition into civvy life. Check out www.australianwarfighters.com to find out more or to purchase their epic coffee. As we welcome them into the team, into the tribe of the Managing Violence Podcast. If any of our listeners out there purchase anything from AustralianWarfighters.com, send me your receipt to joe@joesaunders.com.au and I will send you an Australian Warfighters Velcro patch to throw on your gear and rep the brand publicly. We thank them for their service and for supporting the show. I'm joined by the Pitmaster, John Hackleman, legendary trainer, fighter, mind, martial artist, and all-around fun dude. John, thanks for making the time to be on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, John, we could probably do a whole season of podcasts talking about your career and your experience in the martial arts and so on, but we dived straight in the prelude while we're just chatting, and you said, I need to ask you about the gun incident. So we're going to start completely off track and start talking about the gun incident.
Well, as you know, a lot of people know, I have a martial arts gym. I have a brick and mortar gym. I have an online gym, and I train fighters. Those are my three main things. But during my brick and mortar gym, all of a sudden there's like riots and protests, which are turning into riots. And one was scheduled for our town, which is a little town, Arroyo Grande, California. And it's for the most part a peaceful place. But I mean, there's been murders here and stabbings, and it's not like we lock our door, you know, it's not like you know, all rainbows and unicorns. But anyway, so we got a protest showing up, but we started hearing buzz the week of, it was supposed to be on a Friday, that it was going to turn into a riot. People were being bussed in from LA and stuff. So I started getting really nervous because I saw what happened in LA, Santa Monica, you know, Long Beach, everywhere, basically. And including a martial arts school in Long Beach that heard it was a peaceful protest. So they didn't even show up to protect their gym. It got burned to the ground. I mean, burned to the ground. I can't let that happen to my gym. You know, that's my life. I started hearing these things. So the morning of the alleged protest, a cop called me, police officer, and said, "Hey, I hope you're ready because this is going to get really violent." So I was like, "Oh shit, okay, I can't afford it. I mean, this is my gym. This is my life." So I got some of my top students together, and we made a plan. And part of the plan was they're going to have people on the roof because we have roof access from our gym. We don't have to climb up on a ladder. We have roof access from inside of our gym. So we thought that would be a good idea because we could also protect our community. So both of them had guns. And that was kind of like the Koreans in...
Yeah, I was going to say, you've got your rooftop Koreans.
Yep. So they stood there, but they had a walkie-talkie, and they were, you know, they weren't going to shoot. They weren't going to do anything but deter people from trying to, you know, do any kind of damage, basically in eye shot. And they both had walkie-talkies, and we had people all along the street with walkie-talkies, like, so these guys could see what was going on. So they're on top of the roof with the guns, and we're a martial arts school. So the people never get bussed in. So it's just basically our little, very soft white people yelling, "We hate the cops, Black Lives Matter." It was like a fairy tale version of a riot. So we look like the bullies, you know? Because I was expecting like a mass riot, like LA riots, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it didn't happen. So we look like we overshot it. So people are just going nuts, you know, complaining, and people are calling in, wanting a shutdown. There's a hashtag boycott our gym.
Really?
Yeah. And so I started getting a little worried. I'm on radio stations, TV stations, the newspaper. And it started off with like, why do you do that? You know, who's going to steal anything from a gym? Why a martial arts gym? I go, they don't steal things. They burn the buildings down. That's what they're, 30% of all these protests turn into riots. 30%. That's a huge percentage. So, you know, we got a lot of hate, you know, boycott this, boycott that. But then all of a sudden, like within a day or two, like people are stopping me at Walmart, hugging me, telling me to thank you for protecting our community. I'm getting calls. I'm getting, you know, people. So it turned into, you know, like four people quit their membership from our gym because these guys had guns and they were, oh God, why would they do that? Yeah, to protect my business. But anyway, but then we started getting people signing up, you know, like, hey, we just want to be part of what you're doing. You know, you're protecting our community. So it turned into a really good thing. But at first, it was kind of scary for the first 24 hours, and then it kind of flip-flopped. Now it's a great thing.
Well, I mean, it shows you the authenticity. You're not going to tuck tail and run, which is
no,
we're gonna... kind of cool.
Yeah. So that was that. So
all right. Dude.
Anyway,
hashtag the pit gun incident. All right, John, I wanted to. Wanted to backtrack way back. Kaju Kenbo is like one of those arts that I wish I knew more about. I think like most people, I first came aware of it from Fight Quest. And obviously Hawaiian Kenpo and Chuck Liddell and obviously the mainstream publicity you got there. But as a martial artist, I'm really interested in your origin story. I know you're born in New York, grew up in Hawaii. How'd you end up in martial arts?
I grew up in Hawaii and, I think moved there when I was like four. And during my it wasn't really a nice neighborhood. It wasn't a, you know, like we weren't starving or anything, but it was a very rough neighborhood. Like almost all anyone in a square mile, there's like 10 people that ended up in prison, you know? Mm. And it was a rough, people like to fight in Hawaii, you know? And we grew up in it was a rough area. It was a rough neighborhood. So my mom didn't want me to go to this rough school because she knew they didn't like Haoles, white people, you know? And it was really, they were really rough with them. So we were right on the border. So she sent me to a nicer school, which kind of wasn't a good thing because there's no nicer junior high school. So if you go to the nicer, softer elementary school, most of the people that went there ended up going to private school, like Obama. He went to Punahou, which was a very rich school. There's no violence. It's a very soft, you know, culture there. But so going to this softer elementary school, I knew once I hit junior high school, I heard horror stories about kill Haole Day, beat up Haoles, you know, just how terrible it was going to be. So right about fifth grade, it started hitting me like, shit, I don't know what to do. I could never go to private school. We couldn't afford that, you know, and I got to go to this junior high school. So it was like, I don't know what to do. And my mom and my dad, you know, I didn't really talk to them much. It was a different era back then, and they were busy doing their own thing. And so it was a kind of a thing I went through, you know. So I started looking in the Yellow Pages, and I found a Yellow Page ad I liked. So I called it on my own, and I said, hey, I want to train and learn how to fight and protect myself. And the guy was like, yeah, come on down. We're such and such. I was like fifth grade. So I told my mom, well, he told me it was, I think it was $15. And I was like, okay. So she writes me a check, $15 or whatever it was. I catch two buses. I get there and I walked in. It was like 500 square feet. All I had was like a couple makiwaras and one heavy bag. And it was just empty room with a little office off to the side. And I was like, as soon as I walked in, I thought, I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. I just got a feeling, even at that age, I got a feeling this is my future. I love this place. I didn't know anything about it. So I go in and meet my instructor, Walter Godin, who was in and out of prison, very rough, tough, guy. I think he spent 25, 30 years in prison, wow. But he happened to be out for a little while. So, you know, I go into the office, you just go out there. There was no kids classes. It was just a rough system, Kaja Kempo. And so I started training there. And even though it was rough, and I was like, there was one other white kid, Kevin Coleman. I just knew this was going to be my life. And, you know, it was as rough as and just minimalistic as it was. It was like on the second floor of this strip mall in an industrial area. And I ended up catching the bus there every freaking day for the next 5-6 years. Then I got a car and I drove there every day until I graduated high school and joined the Army. So from like 9 to 18, I was probably there, you know, every single day.
Wow.
So that was my home. That shaped me, molded me, without that and my instructor, Walter Godin, who's passed away since, without him guiding me into, you know, how to be a man, you know, my dad's moral compass helped me a lot. But I needed that toughness. And without that, to this day, I'd probably still be wearing a floral dress or something. So I owed him, it was an experience that I couldn't have lived without. And I thank God every day that I made that call and I went there.
Yeah, that's a cool story. I've always thought that any martial art that's developed on the islands is going to be based around real scrapping. What was your training like? What were the classes like? What was the intensity like?
It was nothing like mine now. Physically, we did some push-ups here and there, did some sit-ups, some bag work. There was a lot of drilling and sparring and contact. There was a lot of all street scenarios, even though I became a kickboxer and I still train there and stuff. And I had to actually go to a different gym when I started kickboxing. So I was actually going to two gyms. But it was, everything was about the street. Everything was like how to take them down and pound them on the ground and, you know, how to, you know, clinch here, elbow to eye gouge. And we drilled. And then we did free sparring a lot. And there was no kids classes. So it was just a bunch of people beating the shit out of each other. The conditioning, he didn't push conditioning like I do. But you got in pretty good shape sparring and drilling all day. But he didn't push the calisthenics part like I do. So it was a rough place with a lot of rough, most of his instructors, you know, we all wore the black gis, and his instructors were like his henchmen. Like they would do his pickups and his, you know, strong arming and other, you know, stuff like that. I found that out later. So it was kind of, his gym was kind of like a front for some other businesses that he had going on. So like, even as a kid, I was like, I would always think, why are all those weird, rough looking guys going into his office and closing the doors? What does that have to do with martial arts? But so Godin was like that. But he always took really good care of me. And he I looked up to him so much, and he created, the toughness in me. Like I said, without him, without my dad, I wouldn't have had such a strong moral compass. And without Godin, I wouldn't have been so tough. So with that, if it was just one or the other, it would have been lopsided.
So you leave Hawaii and join the army. Did you train while you're in the army, or is that something you did?
I joined the army to go to Iran because they got the hostages. So I had just finished high school, and I was like, I had my first kid, and I was like working, concentrating on fighting, and I was gonna, turn pro as a fighter. But I was, I have a kid now and a wife, so I'm working full time as well. Then boom, they take the hostages, and I was like, oh shit, now I gotta go fight in Iran because there's gonna be a war. So I went down to the recruiter, and I asked my dad, what should I do? Because he was in the army. He was in World War II. So he goes, you have to be in the infantry. So I was like, okay. So I went down to the recruiter. I said, I want to be in the infantry. And boom. So I joined the army, go to basic training, and go to my duty station after basic training. And they give the hostages back. So I was like, oh, shit, okay. So I was like,
You've already signed up.
Yeah, I was like, fuck. So I went down to my first sergeant in the office. I go, okay, made a mistake. I got to go out now. I want to become a fighter. There's no war going on, so I don't need to be here. You're in the infantry. That's all infantry does. Like all the other jobs in the army, you got a job. Mechanic, computer stuff, cook, medic, all that. Infantry fights. That's all they do in a war. So there's nothing to do. You're on downtime. So he goes, hey, he recognized me. He goes, hey, you're John Hackelman. You won the Golden Gloves last year. I go, yeah. He happened to be from Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, yeah. He goes, fight for the army. I was like, what does that mean? So he facilitated it for Sergeant Weary, Marcus Weary. So I tried out for, which was no easy task. I tried out for and made the Army boxing team. So basically that's all I did the rest of my time in the Army. And then I got out, I got out of the Army, and I continued the fight career.
Yeah. Wow. So So you came back to Hawaii after the army, like
No, right out of the army, I had an offer to be on the police force in Hawaii because we had a lot of connections there. My dad was a well-known guy because he was a newspaper writer. So I wanted to try fighting first. So I told myself I'm going to go to LA because that's, it's a big fight town, and I'm going to try my fight career. And within a month, I gave myself a month because I had a kid and I couldn't, I can't not make money. I actually had two kids by then. So I was like, I want to get a fight, an apartment, and a job within a month. I'm going to stay here. And if I don't get all three, I'm going to go back to Hawaii and become a cop, and I'll spend the rest of my career being a cop. So I went to Hawaii. I went to LA, walking along the beach because my mom lived in Venice Beach. So I'm walking along the beach and I looked and I saw a gym. Walked in, I had a fight scheduled. I had a fight, I had a job, because I found a job that day too. And then I all I needed was an apartment, which I got the next day. So within my first week, I had a job, an apartment, and a fight all scheduled. So I stayed in LA and I'm still here in California.
Yeah, wow. So so you're focusing on your own career. I take it you're like, what, early 20s at this point? So
Yeah.
So when did you start training people?
I've always done that on the side, a little here and there. Even in the Army, I was I did some training for some of the guys. But I just concentrated on my own fighting for a little while. And then I had my third kid, and then the fighting wasn't making any money. I was a hard hitter. I won a world title or two in kickboxing. Boxing, I was so. I just hit hard. I wasn't really that good. So I knew kickboxing, I wasn't going to make much money, even though I was a world champion. So I went to college, became a registered nurse, and I couldn't train like I wanted to, even though, because I'm not working, I'm supporting, I have three kids, I'm working as a full-time nurse. So I built a little gym in my backyard. And next thing you know, I'm training guys back there. Like, people heard about it. And next thing you know, it's called The Pit, and it created what The Pit is. And that started in my backyard as a 400 square foot little gym. And next thing I know, I got guys like Chuck and everybody in that. So I was doing that, but I was still fighting on the side. Then my career kind of took a backseat to theirs. And then I just completely, retired from fighting altogether, which, it wasn't a big deal like when Chuck retired. And then I just started training people. So it probably transitioned in like 94, 95 to where I just started training people full time.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of the biggest gyms or the best known gyms started off in a garage or a backyard or very rarely do you hear about a top level gym that's had any longevity that started off with a massive $2 million investment in a luxury flight center that was always designed to be a massive commercial success. Like, very rarely do those gyms actually hang around. Yeah. It's always like you need to have that. That tough upbringing of training in a freezing cold garage or outside of the elements or something to build some longevity in the business and the loyalty in the students. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about training fighters versus training martial artists, and I guess why people get into it. Now, I assume when you started, you made the shift over to full-time coaching in 94. I mean, most of the people that would have been coming to train with you didn't have any expectations of being UFC champions because that wasn't even a thing. Were they mostly coming to train for the martial arts side or the combat sports side, do you think?
It's martial arts. It still is. I'm probably 90% martial artist. I'm like 95% martial artist, 10% guys that want to fight. But to be honest, like, most of my teaching careers, 95% martial artists. But the only time that changed is, you know, right at the height of Chuck. Then all of a sudden, like, I got a bunch of new fighters and people wanted to be, you know, wanted to fight then. And so when Chuck was at his highest, that's when I had more fighters, but never more fighters than, you know, students. I mean, I start my guys at 3 years old. So it's like, you know, we have the biggest kids class in the county. So it's not like, you know, but that's when I had my biggest surge of fighters was during the Chuck era. Because I've never really reached out to be a fight trainer. I've always wanted to be a martial arts instructor. And it just happened. Chuck wanted to fight. So next thing you know, it's all about Chuck and the fighting and this and that. But other than that, before that and after that, it's, you know, it's almost all about my students. You know, they have some fighters on the side like Glover, and I have a small team that I train right now too.
What was your first impression of a young Chuck Liddell when he walked into your gym?
He didn't just walk into my gym. I went to his gym and fought him.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so maybe tell that story. How did you guys get connected?
There was a guy in town, he was a traditional karate guy, and Chuck used to train with him, I guess. He's being a douchebag to me, and he called me, and I just moved into this town from LA, and, you know, had my backyard gym, and I was working full-time as a nurse, and I kind of got a reputation real quick, because I was, you know, I went into a couple gyms, and we had some dojo wars, and anyway, so he called me and said what he thought I was doing was, you know, not good for the art of martial arts. And, you know, it's guys like me that give it a bad reputation. And, you know, he's more about the street and I'm all about sport. And I don't think he knew my background. So I said, well, if you think that's true, why don't we find out? I'll come down there and we can do it under street rules. And, you know, we can find out, you know, how, you know, which is better for the street. So he goes, okay. So we scheduled it and for Friday. And I went down there with my dad, and I was expecting just to meet with him in a parking lot or go to his dojo and just throw down with him. But he was in his office. I went into his dojo, and he's in his office, and he's telling me how his back was bugging him. But I could go out. I could go with one of his students instead. So I was like, all right. So he pointed me in the direction of Chuck, and so me and Chuck went at it a little bit, and, you know, I could tell that Chuck wasn't, you know, up to my, you know, experience level in real fighting. So Chuck asked me if I would train him, and I said, yeah. I gave him my card, and he came by the next morning, and I trained him ever since.
Wow. So how old was Chuck then? What's the time frame?
20-ish.
Okay, right. Yeah, cool. So he was already wrestled and been training karate for a little bit. Yeah. Interesting. I never heard that story before. That's very cool.
It's in his book. But his book makes it sound like it was a lot more brutal than it was.
It was a little bit more blood sport?
In his book, yeah. He writes about it in his book. He has a book.
Yeah, I need to pick that up. I remember it coming out a little while ago. Actually, it'd be interesting because I read Tito's book years ago. I'd be interested to compare the stories. How do you approach training competitive fighters versus training martial artists? I mean, obviously, some martial artists, certainly many listeners of this podcast, train very seriously without any expectation of getting in a ring or a cage. So how do you approach that training differently? Or is there a difference?
There's a difference in the goal of their training, but there's no difference in the way I get them to their goals. So they both have a different goal, right? So for my kids, it's not to be bullied, to be anti-bullied. Okay. For my adult black belt guys, it's to not let anyone take their lunch money, not to be jumped, defend yourself and your family, to be able to protect yourself and be in good health. And then for my fighters, it's to win a world UFC title. And so there's three different goals at the end of the tunnel, but getting there is the same: hard work, training, discipline, good diet, conditioning, you know, so to get there is the same. And then the only other difference is the mental preparation. Mentally preparing someone for a fight, you know, most of the time, not always, sometimes they'll take a fight last minute, but most of the time they're in camp. So you're working with them physically as well as mentally. But in our martial arts school, right, they're always having to be ready in case someone jumps them that night on the way to the car. So the mental preparation is a little different. But the way to get there is the same. Like the way to get there in the cage is to be in the top shape and to be, you know, have your techniques, your takedown defense, your striking, you know, and your physical conditioning all top of the line. And that's going to give you more confidence if you get jumped in the street. Conditioning, you know, getting your takedown defense, your takedowns, your striking, your mount escapes, your grappling and all that in good order. And then adding that into being top shape, that is your psyching out for the fight too. So both those things equal extreme confidence. And there's no better, you know, sports psychology than being confident because you know you're competent.
That's a really good point. And I think that's something I've argued with some of the reality-based crowd over the years, is that this idea that sport fighters can't fight on the street, or they wouldn't be able to manage a no-rules environment. And my argument's always been, well, you've got someone who's in incredible shape, who trains all the time, who is strong, fit, fast, and confident in their skills. That's going to be more than enough for nearly any street altercation. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that on the street you can stick a thumb in someone's eye when you've got them mounted, as opposed to having to be limited to punching. I want to drill down on something you talked about mental toughness and discipline. It's something that I just had Tim Kennedy on the show last week, and we talked a lot about mental toughness. And
where did he start? At the Pit.
Oh, really? Oh, I did. Yeah, I didn't know he started off at the Pit.
He's from our county. Yeah.
Ah, there you go. Wow, we didn't even talk about that. Damn, there's a natural segue. But yeah, I mean, so I had Tim on talking about mental toughness in the war zone and so on. How do you go about instilling mental toughness? I mean, obviously, a lot of the kids that you're training, the teens and becoming young adults, you're talking about your community before. I mean, a lot of them haven't dealt with conflict. They're kind of soft. How do you go about transforming them into a tougher human being?
With the training, with making the training uncomfortable instead of not, like katas or whatever they do at most karate schools. Ours is more tough, you know, it is tougher. The conditioning, and it's the training. A lot of places like do what they call character development, and they do, so they have like weeks where it's like, this week we're going to talk about perseverance, and then you get a little stripe that says perseverance. This week it's going to be coordination. This week it's going to be, I don't know, whatever. But you know, to me, that comes more from like examples, like if the kid's drilling or even sparring or grapple, whatever, and he starts crying, you know, instead of like letting him run to mommy and cry, you know, make him finish that round, you know. Cry all you want, but finish the round, you know, unless they got like a hanging off their fucking arms snapped off and shit, or their eyeballs coming out or some shit. I mean, because 99% of the time, it's not a real injury. It's just they got their a little owie or something. So I don't know, kind of that goes, and I do that with my adults too, obviously, where I don't, you know, being a registered nurse helps too, but you know, me like a kid says he can't breathe and he can't do any of the laps anymore, so I'll call him over, I'll listen to his lungs, and if he's not wheezing, I'll say, get out, keep running, you don't have asthma, go, you know, stuff like that, you know. And I think it is a tougher gym, just like the gym I came up with was. So I think it's doing more than just saying, like when you try to toughen up a kid, and you never hear Joe Rogan say, well, that guy's terrible, he's just way too tough, you know?
Yeah.
You can't be too tough. Okay, I don't want a tough guy who acts like a tough guy. I don't want that. He's out of here. But I want a tough person.
Yeah.
You know, I want a person that has toughness. There's no downside to being tough. You cannot be too tough, but you can definitely be not tough enough. And that's very easy, especially in this day and age.
Yeah. Although I'll tell you what, if there was ever a guy that was too tough for his own good, I think immediately of Vincent in a way, especially that fight against Igor Vovchanchin back in Pride 10, where Vincent went to hospital for like 6 weeks or something after that fight.
Yeah, but when you're there's things called a referee and there's things called coaches to throw in a towel. But when you're, you know, when I say tough enough, I mean for the street. But
yeah.
But sometimes people that you know, they say they're too tough for their own good, but that's why there's a coach. That's why there's a towel to get thrown in. So that's when you have a very tough guy and a coach that thinks, you know, oh, I'm tough too because he's tough, you know.
Yeah.
That's poor coaching and too tough.
Yeah. I think Ensign's problem was his brother had the same mindset. I think Egan would have been worried about the repercussions from Ensign if he threw the towel in for him. Although I can't remember if it was a towel throw or was it a doctor stoppage in the after the first round. But anyway, it was.
I'm the one that threw in the towel when Cesar Gracie fought Frank Shamrock.
Oh, yeah. I'm really fascinated with the transitions between, you know, being a martial artist, being a sport fighter, going from being a sport fighter to coach, and the transitions that we all go through in different phases of our career. You know, for me personally, like growing up as a martial artist and getting into sport fighting and then hitting a point where the injuries are mounting up and it's like, well, you know, like you said, yeah, I've got kids to raise. I've got a family to feed. I can't afford to be out of work because I'm injured all the time. And then those transitions that you make. When you've got a fighter, let's say when Chuck is hitting that end of his career, so it seemed like his chin was failing him or maybe his reflexes were slowing down. Like, how did you start having those conversations with him about what's the next phase?
Towards the end of his career when I had him, I was just trying to change up. Once he lost his chin, I tried to change up his game plans because it wasn't going to work anymore. He was always the guy that wanted to go in and you couldn't change that because then that's not going to be him and he won't do it. So that would be impossible, you know. But towards the end, so I'm trying to get him to do more. He's such a good wrestler, such good takedowns, so good on the ground. So trying to get him to slug less, you know, and go in for more takedowns, work his jab more, keep his distance more until he can get a shot or score more points at least, but not go in slugging all the time. But that didn't work very well because he didn't want it. He wouldn't do it. He did it for like the first 5 seconds. And then as soon as he got hit or he hit the guy, he would just go back, resort back. So we couldn't. I mean, he just wouldn't listen. You can't, you know, just like you can't make Thiago Sanchez turn into a boxer, or you can't turn Arturo Gatti into a, you know, Muhammad Ali. It wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. So he wouldn't do that. So I tried to have that talk with him, but once the chin goes, it's not going to come back. So his style didn't fit him anymore towards the end. And, it was sad, but, you know, that's some people just aren't going to change their ways. They just won't. And he wouldn't.
Yeah, it is interesting to see how many fighters now are continuing on into their 40s. I mean, we just saw Fabricio Werdum on the weekend. 40, 43, I think. And looking like $1 million. It is interesting, especially in the quote unquote post TRT era of fighters and just how many guys are actually doing well in their 40s. It feels like it wasn't that long ago that Randy Couture was like the great grandfather of MMA because he was still fighting at 40. And now, it's like fairly normal. For guys to be still hovering around the top 10 at 40.
Yeah, Glover's looking as good as he's ever looked, and he's 40.
Yeah, it's amazing. How has culture changed in relation to martial arts? I mean, you obviously got into martial arts primarily from a self-protection point of view. Worried about being bashed at school, which is a reason why I think a lot of us got into martial arts. I do find now, like, hanging around gyms, a lot of kids are getting into it because they want to be on UFC. Like, they want to be on TV. They want to be, they don't even watch the old school martial arts movies that we grew up with. They want to be Chuck Liddell, or probably more to the point, they want to be Stipe, for example.
I don't see that. I don't see that at my gym.
No, you're finding they're still coming in for the same reasons as before.
Yeah, I mean, I get a couple, a couple of the older guys, not older, but like in their 20s, that want to fight. So, I get those, but I think, maybe out of, I think probably 1%, maybe 2% of the people that are in my adult program from 14 on up, want to ever have a inclination to fight in a cage or a ring ever. I just don't think. Sometimes they do after they've been training a while, and they go, "Hey, I want to try this," So I have a couple guys that do compete that way, but I have very few people that join my gym to compete unless they go in through the "I want to be on the fight team" door. So yeah, and none of my kids. I never heard one of my from 3 to 14. I've never heard any of them say, "I want to be a UFC fighter" ever. They just, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, that's really interesting. Really interesting.
Maybe it's our town. Maybe it's just our town. I don't know.
Maybe it is interesting though, given your reputation and I guess where your fame, I guess, came from.
Yeah, it's a weird one because I think the same way. And a lot of people don't want to come into my gym because I have a reputation of the toughest gym in town and Chuck Liddell and everybody's fighting and kicking the ass and there's blood and people. A huge percentage of people that actually come in and join say, "Oh shit, man, we've been driving by here for 5 years. We've been too scared to come in, but man, you're actually a family gym. We thought you'd be there'd be blood on the wall and we'd get beat up. So we just peeked in. We said, "Hey, wait a second, it's a family gym." So there's that misconception of our gym a lot. But very few people. This is not a fight town. I don't think there's not, most of the people that fought for me that, like Glover and Cord and Chuck and Tim Kenny. Well, Tim Kenny was from here, but most of the people came here to train here. Very few people from this town are going to turn into fighters because it's not a soft town. It's just a softish town.
Yeah. Okay. So just as we're winding up, I'm really interested in, we talked at the start about Kaju Kembo. And one of the things that I really like about some of the videos I've seen of you in recent years. Yeah. I love that you still got that traditional martial arts heart. Like, I mean, you talk a lot of things that we don't necessarily hear from, the MMA community. You talk a lot about character development. You talk a bit about, the traditions and the strength in Kaju Kenbo. Do you still teach Kaju Kenbo as a system, or does it influence how you teach what you do teach? Talk to me about that sort of evolution for you.
I teach, like all my students know about my lineage. We have the family tree of Kaju Kenbo on my wall. I'm true to Kaju Kenbo. I'm loyal to Kaju Kenbo. But I don't teach Kaju Kenbo at all. I teach the philosophy of Kaju Kenbo never left me. And if it wasn't for the philosophies, the concept and the mental toughness, which came with the physical toughness, then like I said, I'd be wearing a floral dress right now and I'd be somebody's girlfriend right now. If it wasn't for martial arts and how it made me tough. And I still teach that. And I still embrace that. I still thrive on that. My students, all of them have that. Anyone that makes it up the ladder in their belts adapts that. I even have orthopedic surgeons that don't even look, I have an orthopedic surgeon that doesn't look like the same, he doesn't walk down the street the same anymore. He's still an orthopedic surgeon, but he knows if you even lay a fucking hand on him, you're going out. He knows it. He knows it now. And that's in him now. He knows it. He didn't before. He never walked around like that before. So I do embrace the martial arts, the martial art philosophies of Kaju Kenbo. I never really got into the Asian ones. Like, you know, I love Shotokan and the Koikan, you know, Kyoshishin. I love all that stuff. I didn't grow up with it. I grew up with Kaju Kenpo. And the thing that Kaju Kenpo didn't have that they had was the moral compass. Kaju Kenpo guys were known for being notoriously criminals. A lot of the Kaju Kenpo guys ended up in prison, like my instructor, you know, manslaughter, murder, strong-arming, you know, stuff like that. And in Hawaii, it was huge. A lot of the Kaju Kenpo guys, they didn't have the same, you know, humbleness that the more the Asian arts had, you know. And so I had to, that came from my dad, that part of it. He was a very, you know, very morally, you know, direct, morally high guy with a lot of morals and, you know, a lot of integrity. So that came from him. But the Kaju Kenpo was a tough, rough, kick his ass, fuck him, stomp him, spit on him, walk away kind of thing. Nowadays, it's not that much like that. And it's not as tough, you know. They do Sifu and Sigung. They use Chinese terminology, which is, whenever they do that, I know they came from the new Kaju Kenpo. Old Kaju Kenpo wasn't like that. It was, you know, master, you know, it was instructor, chief instructor, you know, master, grandmaster, professor. We didn't use, there was no Chinese terminology or any of that. So, so that's one of the things. It kind of, it softened when it came to the mainland. Kaju Kenpo started in Hawaii in 1947. And then it softened when it started coming to the mainland. It had to, because nobody's going to train like that. Nobody's going to, I'm not, you know, hardly anyone. And you're definitely not going to have a successful school doing that. So I think I found a good balance of the toughness and the, you know, the school friendly, the family friendly feel. I think I have that, and I like that. I, you know, I wouldn't have minded it being more like that when I was coming up, but it wasn't, so I'm not going to cry about it. But my gym is like that. It's a family friendly, very tough mentality. Always strike first, but never start the fight. And that's kind of confusing for some people, but it's not to guys that have trained with me for any length of time. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. I like what you say there about the balance. I mean, you, no one wants to be completely Cobra Kai, but yeah, also sometimes Daniel looks like a bit of a pussy. So
yeah. And if you look at that video they have on YouTube, he's the bad guy too. Yeah. Or just like the new, new series. Yeah. He's not the good guy. You don't take, just because you don't say something back, like if someone cusses you out, by not cussing them out, that doesn't always mean you take the high road. That just means you took the whatever road, but it wasn't necessarily the high road, you know? Yeah. Hitting someone over anger, that's low. Hitting someone over a threat, that's low, you know? But hitting someone first, sometimes that's necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have a guy on the podcast in a couple of weeks, Tim Larkin, who read the book When Violence is the Answer. Yeah.
You gotta check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Really.
I gotta
really
write a book. My book's gonna be called Don't Let Anyone Take Your Lunch Money.
Oh, nice. Are you writing a book currently?
Kind of. Master Wong. You know who Master Wong is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good friend of mine. He's been bugging the shit out of me to write one. he thinks I should have two right now. But I've kind of started like a little by little. It's in you know. So it's bits and pieces. I'm going to start one.
Very good, man. I hope that comes to fruition, because I'd love to get a copy. I think, as I said, we could break down your career and do, you know, a 10-part series for sure. But for those that are going to leave us here, I know you're going to hang around and do the bonus questions with us in a minute. But for those that are leaving us here, if they want to find out more about you, John, where can they go?
Pit_master at Instagram. That's my favorite.
All right, on Instagram. Obviously, I'll put your websites and so on in the show notes. John, thank you very much for your time. We're going to do the bonus round in just a minute, but thanks very much. It was a great conversation.
All right, thanks, brother.
Thank you once again to Pitmaster John Hackleman for sharing his time and expertise with us. Make sure you support him on Instagram at pit_master and also his website, thepitmma.com. Don't forget, if you want to hear bonus content from John Hackleman and all our previous guests, go on to patreon.com/managingviolence. Check that out. Also, please support our sponsors, Australian Warfighters Coffee. We'll be back next week with guest Tim Larkin, author of When Violence is the Answer. It's a great show. You don't want to miss it. Until next time, I'll talk to you soon.